Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast and the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we'll be discussing. Today, I am joined by my friend Will. Will, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Zach. Appreciate it. Great to be here.
Absolutely. You know, it's been a really long time coming. I've gotten to know you over the last year and ever since the election last year. And now I know you're running in your own election. So we'll get to that here in just a minute. But I would love for you to walk, you know, introduce yourself to our audience, introduce, you know, the work that you've been doing, what led you into it. And you have some 9/11 experience. So let's begin with that. And then we'll just walk through your journey.
So that's a lot to unpack there. First, shout out to Zach and everyone at the Rise Above Justice Movement team for their ongoing and consistent advocacy for what maybe the last 2 years, I believe. And just really quick, how to bring it all together. Zach had posted online, really just pissed off about what was happening at the federal level. Creating this movement, and so I instantly reached out. Surprisingly, we have so many connections that we didn't even realize, and know individuals within the same systems and within the same work. And it's been great, being organized and supporting the work that Zach is doing and the Rise Above Justice movement team is doing. And so, as far as myself, me, Will Rivera, longtime New Yorker, very proud New Yorker, proud Boricua. Born and raised in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, shout out LES. Now I live in upstate New York, where I really have dedicated my life to service, just due to my own experiences, and really excited to talk about all that with y'all today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I admire the work that you do, and I love, you know, your platform that you have, which, you know, again, we'll get to you running an office here in just a minute, because I think it's deeply important to recognize the need for progressive voices to run in places like New York to continue that progress moving forward, even on like the local level, because every single election matters, regardless of how big or how small it is. Every single election matters. And I think hitting on that, you know, as a very, there's a lot that goes into it. And there's a lot that we can talk about there. And you were diagnosed with cancer after 9/11. I
Yeah,
know.
so yeah. So go ahead. You want me to go on?
So I think, you know, obviously, I know that this can get very emotional. So we can do like a brief, like, touch on it because you've had quite the journey. And, you know, my mom is also battling stage 3 cervical cancer. She was diagnosed in April, and she just finished going through her radiation and her chemotherapy, and finally, you know, is on that road to healing, right? But I cannot lie and say that I haven't thought about it every single day. And, you know, as I told you, whenever we first connected, my mom is my biggest inspiration behind everything. You know, my mom's a survivor. She's a warrior. And I know she's been through hell and back, but I honestly have to say that this has probably been the worst of all of it. Me and her have been through hell and back together, but at the same time, I know that she's going to come out stronger than ever. And, you know, I told her a little bit about your story, Will, which has obviously, you know, inspired her to keep going, and she knows a little bit about it. And, you know, based on the little bit that I know about it, but yeah, I'm just excited to sit down and talk to you. You know, it's been a long time coming. And to anybody out there who's listening, this is a deeply personal conversation because Will is my biggest supporter and my biggest inspiration. So, and he keeps me in line.
Geez. Thank you, Zach, for all that. Right back at you again. I deeply admire and respect and look up to you and the movement you have created with your team, and your mom. All the blessings and healing vibes her way. Obviously, I can resonate with a lot of it. But so let's start from the beginning, I guess, right? So I was sitting in drug treatment court here, and I was talking with my friends, and I was like, gosh, my chest hurts. It feels weird. It feels like my heart's skipping a beat. And so they're like, go to the doctor, go to the doctor. So I go to the doc, I go to the emergency room actually. I tell my wife, oh, I'm not feeling good, so I'm just gonna go to the emergency room. I'm fine, like no big deal. And so, they started at the emergency room, they start doing some tests, they do an x-ray, and I'm sitting there just like waiting, thinking it's nothing. And to this day I see it and really can understand it. But the doctor comes in and he looks at me, right? And I could see it in his face, like just the dread and like horror of like telling someone. He's like, you have cancer. He's like, you have a cantaloupe size, melon size, mass, in your like mediastinum, so like my chest neck area. And like I was like, I knew it. As soon as he came in, I said to him, I was like, I have fucking cancer, right? Like I know it. And he like I just knew it. And then everything just spiraled, right? Like all the what ifs and the isms and the thoughts. My daughter at the time was what? She hadn't been just like 11 months, 10, 11 months, and I was like literally at the what I thought was like the peak of my career, here locally. And so all the thoughts just go in your head at that time. And then, I didn't even tell my wife over the phone. I was like, oh, I'm fine, I'll be home in a little bit. And I had to bring a friend of ours, to the house because I just knew it wasn't going to be good. So, of course I told my wife and just devastated. But, from that path, I knew I had to fight, obviously, for all the reasons, why, right? My family, my wife, my daughter, myself, my community. And I just wanted to start the fight. I just wanted to start the battle, right? I've struggled my whole life. I fought for my whole life. I've been through it all. Like most of us, from yourself and RJAM, right? Like many of us have struggled. Many of us battle, continue to battle. And through that struggle, like I knew it was like, all right, just get me started, get me the treatments. But from there, I was going driving, from upstate New York to New York City for treatment at Memorial Sloan Kettering because like rural healthcare is just not, what it needs to be, and I wanted to at least go to where the experts were. But the 6 months of treatment of chemotherapy, and my first treatment was actually like a day or two before my daughter's 1 year old birthday party. And so we did all that traveling back and forth. I would get treatment. We'll leave here at like 5 in the morning. I get treatment down there, which is always like a long process. And then we would leave there at like 7, 8 o'clock at night and get and come straight home, which is again like 3.5 hour trip one way. But 6 months it still wasn't gone. So then I had to find an expert. Who I was guided through a Facebook group. A woman reached out and said, go see this man. And so he sat me down. We talked for like hours, and he said, listen, you need to buckle up. If you were my son, this is what you're gonna do. So he put me on this experimental treatment. I did a stem cell transplant, where I was in the inpatient for a month, doing the whole masking and gowning and all the precautions before COVID was even a thing. And literally lived in the hospital for a month. And then had to do radiation for another month, and then had to do about maintenance treatments for about 1.5 years. And God willing, I'm here. I'm here today. I'm healthy-ish, right? Because there's a lot of things I still have to do. But through this struggle, as everyone who knows me knows that, I'm just a natural helper. And so the social workers at the hospital said, hey, Will, can you meet with someone? because he's a young adult, has a daughter as well. He's a firefighter with the New York City Fire Department. Can you talk to him? And so his name was Jimmy. I talked to him. Him and I like really connected and supported each other through the processes. But unfortunately, Jimmy didn't make it through his treatments from his complications from his stem cell transplant, because we all had literally the same treatments, the same, every down to the same medications. But unfortunately, he couldn't recover from a health-related issue during his transplant. But what he had told me was, hey, like you lived in the Ground Zero area. I'm a certified victim of the mass terrorist attack, and you should look into that. And I had no idea, honestly, about this, right? And my again, we all lived there down in Lower Manhattan, it was never told to me about this program. And so I applied for it. It wasn't an easy process by any means, as many victim compensation cases are never easy to navigate, even with someone like me who knows how to do claims and navigate the systems. It was still difficult. And so I'm a certified victim of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And I would have never have known about it if Jimmy didn't tell me that this is my Hodgkin's lymphoma is a relatable cancer.
I'm glad that you did find out about it, because it would have left a lot of those questions unanswered, but I admire the way that you tell your story, Will, because it's such a deep and impactful story, and I think it's important to recognize like how far you've come and where you're headed and what you're doing now. I think is deeply incredible. And speaking of which, I want to touch on, some of the work that you've done, because you're involved with a lot of different organizations, and you've done a lot of different like a lot of different advocacy work, and with My Own Image, and you are working with the coalition to close the voluntary loop, the intoxication loophole in New York. So I'd love for you to talk about that, and then just your advocacy for survivors.
Yeah, I mean, like, so, like, start like my why, right? Like, and so my why originates from, like many of us, our own like experiences, right? And as a child, and again, this took me forever to talk about it, but I was a victim of a victim survivor of child abuse, family violence, street violence, and I never realized what my connection was when I was supporting, when I continued to support those who have been harmed, right, by violence. And it took me years to realize it, but my reasoning for it is because I connect with them because of my own experiences, right? I can empathize. I can listen. I can honor their experiences because I'm a survivor myself. Not that, again, a survivor's journey is individualistic. No one's journey is ever going to be the same. That's why I realized why I connect so well with survivors. And so my path down survivor justice work started right out of college, right? Supporting thousands of victims of all sorts of violent crime. Honestly, there isn't a situation that I haven't seen or responded to. Oversaw our local shelters and then proceeded to, be welcomed into, state spaces as advisory capacity or government or governmental appointed or other regional boards, et cetera, and really became a voice for New Yorkers, especially, upstate rural New York, especially programs that are providing this work and just really advocating for, truly survivor-centric work, and also advocating against, spaces that hold power and oppression against, those who are advocating and doing the ground level work, those who may be gatekeeping resources or not paying their staff appropriately, right? I'm here to fight for the people and for the people, because I understand, the necessity of resources. I needed public housing. I needed Medicaid. I needed all the free food, the free lunches. And so unless you don't experience growing up experience that, or even experience these things in general, personally, I just think it's hard to see the barriers that we face through a lived experience lens. And so my goal is always to just lead a path for others. And so, I'm a natural connector. I'm a natural, how do I say, like a virtual Rolodex, right? It's like, oh yeah, I know this person, or I know this person. Yep, this is who you reach out to. And, my goal is to just create the path so those who want to lead or those who truly can talk about their own experiences are up front and center, right? I don't care about speaking. I don't care about the, being up there. It's about the, those who is harmed or those who has experienced these issues to be the one speaking. And it's not about me. I really learned quickly that thinking that way definitely will, how do I say this, cast you out of spaces, which is okay, because then we'll just build our own space, which is like obviously what you're doing, Zach, and the rest of your team, is that we will create our own spaces for the people that need it, and serving the people the way that's truly necessity for them. And so now I'm doing, I'm the managing director of My Own Image, as we navigate this funding crisis as well. And so My Own Image, we are a national org, nonprofit that is focused on battling technology-facilitated gender-based violence and all the intersecting forms of harm associated with that. But primarily right now, just because of capacity and lack of funding, we're focused on image-based abuse. And so image-based abuse is not just like a focus on deep fakes, which is all synthetic generated AI imagery, things like that. Like, we're also looking at authentic images, right? Because we still haven't solved the harm that's done with authentic imagery. And so we really focus on those issues, just because of the reasons why this nonprofit was created, and understand the harm that can be done. And so we've really been successful with that. It's only 2 years of this nonprofit being open. Last year we passed three bills in throughout the country: Arkansas, South Carolina, and Florida. And we passed the New York State Senate, where we are really approaching this from a really multi-stakeholder lens, where we're bringing individuals who are harmed, individual who has done harm, public defenders, experts in all these different realms, to really create this model policy where everyone are really appreciate the way we're looking at it from that way. So that's been really fun. And that, been it's allowed me to do a lot of things that I've always wanted to do, create spaces for others as well. But beyond that, honestly, as I said, I'm a natural connector, and I do all things advocacy. And so what happens is people will reach out to me, or they, may ask for guidance, and I say, actually, like, let's do it together, or happy to hop on and help. And honestly, I don't ask for money. I don't ask for, kudos or anything. I just do it because I truly do love it. Advocacy is who I am and what I do. And I just say, like, I'm the people's advocate, right? Like, if there's something you need me to do, like, I will go, grab that legislator. Like, yep, throw me in, put me in, coach. I'll take care of it, whatever we got to do. And so I've been with that. I've been, supporting many things throughout, the country, and even internationally at this point, just providing that, just that straight, like, grind mentality, the straight, like, grit, and New York City, like, just rough, and like, we'll get it done. We work hard. And that's just who I am. And so I've been able to, support a lot of people that way. I think you wanted me to talk about one of the bills, but here in New York, we have a bill where it's going to be, gosh, 8 or 9 years, I can't even remember now, of us trying to pass it. But essentially, in New York, if you were to willingly become intoxicated, meaning you had to one too many drinks, or you may have taken a substance by your own volition, but then you became then you became sexually assaulted by someone, or assaulted in some way in a sexual form. Now you won't have access to justice. And so, yes, just pause there. I know everyone's like, wait, what are you talking about? So, right now in New York, if I was date raped, right? So someone put a little roofie in my drink or whatever, I was knocked out unconscious, sexually assaulted, I would have access to a crime. I would have access to justice, right? But if I had one too many drinks and became intoxicated, and was sexually assaulted, now I don't have access to justice. And so we are literally seeing cases where individuals who had one too many drinks, and they go to report it to police or go to the DAs, and they actually say, you know, we can't move forward with that. And so all we want to do is just allow survivors to have access to justice, right? That's our goal in this. And we continuously, you know, we're relentless advocates in the spaces for it. But the more and more we do it, I understanding, you know, a lot of the reasons why there's a lot of apprehension to pass this bill or similar criminal justice reform bills, because a lot of these bills, you know, are fo focused on the response by the criminal justice system, which we all know. Listen, me being a person coming from these communities, have historically and continue to impact our historically undervalued communities. You know, our Black and brown men, you know, are we continue to be harmed by these systems. And so I understand the apprehension, and just now, as I continue to do this work, and also be in a potentially person in an elected official capacity, I understand it's all hitting me of like, oh shoot, no, like we really do need to look at that further, or really look at the harm that can be done, because you know, I'm by no way do I ever want to reharm my community, or reharm, you know, potentially harm someone that was innocent, but I truly want to come together and have these discussions and like, there's this is what this exclusion is that we have. How can we close it, right? As a collaborative coalition of advocates, you know, allies, legislators, executive officials, you know, how can we close this for the sake of justice for all New Yorkers? So, you know, here we are, you know, again, either the 8th or 9th year of us trying to do that, and navigate the system. You know, I've learned a lot, and continue to learn a lot just navigating not only this bill, but many others. So we shall see what this session holds for that bill.
And I look forward to continuing on the conversations, you know, with the coalition that you were a part of, and then I've attended a couple of the meetings, and you can feel the energy to need the for this to happen in New York. And it's so incredibly important that it does happen. And I talked to people outside of New York, and I was like, by the way, you know, New York has this. And they looked at me like, wait, what? I was like, yeah. It is deeply troubling that in 2025, and like you said, this has been in the works for the last, what, 8, 9 years? And
Yeah.
it's 2025. And it shows that even in, like, quote unquote, like progressive states, you still have these exact same battles. You know, it doesn't matter if you're in a blue state, red state, whatever, or in a progressive area, you still have these exact same issues, right? And it shows that a lack of education is obviously definitely there for elected officials, for sure. But it also shows where the priorities lie, too. And unfortunately, we know where a lot of the priorities are lying right now. It's not where it needs to be. Because we know that these systems have been deeply harmful to survivors for God knows how long, probably since they've ever been created. I know that from firsthand experience. I saw how they fucked my mom over. I saw how they fucked me over and a lot of my friends and a lot of people that I've been connected to. I see the systems on a daily basis. I mean, you constantly receive, direct messages and emails, and I get text messages like, did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? And it's like, yeah, unfortunately I did. How can I not? Like it's literally on the headlines. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm glad that these issues are being discussed. I just wish it was in a different way, But yeah, let's jump into you running for office. You were running for town supervisor in Oneonta, and I believe I said that correctly. I always struggle saying that name, but you're running for office. What is it like? What's been your experience, and what made you decide to run for office? Because you have a hell of a platform, and you have three top priorities. And those priorities are housing you can afford, safe and healthy communities, and transparent government. So that right there is one hell of a platform, especially coming from your background. Let's jump into each one of these. So housing, what does housing look like to you? Obviously, like an equitable community, there's obviously housing that's not owned by a big corporation like Airbnb, which I can kind of let you know about something that's going on here in Kansas that I think you would be really intrigued by. But we'll jump into that here in just a second. I'll let you know about what's happening after you finish, going through your platform. But housing you can afford, what does that mean to you?
It's housing for all of us, right? It goes back, down to like safe and affordable housing, all the way to, accessible housing for our elderly, right? But what we're facing, not only here in Oneonta, but honestly in New York and across the nation, is an affordability issue, right? Like we literally can't afford to live anymore. And we're even now, with all the changes that are going to potentially or have happened already within the federal government, we're going to see it even harder for us to survive. And I have talked to so many people, that may, are from like maybe a couple of generations older than myself, and they say, well, just work a little harder, right? Like, things like that. And I was like, no, there's no amount of hard work that's ever going to make up the gap, because the home that you may have bought for $100,000 40 years ago now is selling for $700,000. And I'm getting paid maybe $50,000 with a master's degree plus student loans, and maybe have to buy a car that starts at $50,000 plus all the increases in your vehicle insurance and gas prices and the skyrocketing electricity prices and gas prices for your homes. And so that's what I mean, is that we need to have housing for all of us, and also housing that's available to us, because I'm sure this is what you're probably going to say, Zach, is, but we're seeing homes being bought up by developers that don't even live here, right? And then turning them into short-term rentals. And now, they're getting taken off the market. So our professionals, our students who may want to stay here, families who are looking for a home, now can't get into that home because they can't afford to outbid a developer who can drop $300,000 cash price, right? And so now we create this bidding war, we create this, class issue where now people were just going to sell their homes, move out of New York, because like, oh shoot, I could sell my home for $600,000, and you're not going to be able to afford another home here locally, right? Or build a home, so let me go move somewhere else, right? So now we have decreasing population. Now a housing stock is only going to be for a short-term developer, for a short-term rental, and so that's what we're seeing, right? People are saying, I didn't come move into this neighborhood to now have four short-term rentals on my block, and I don't, when I'm knocking on the people's doors and meeting them where at their homes, meeting them where they're at, one in three are saying that same issue, right? Regarding the short-term rental issue. And there's no reason why we should be having, professionals, nurses, teachers, that are living in their cars because they can't afford to buy a home, can't afford to rent a home or apartment, because of the way our current housing situation is here. And so that's what I mean by affordable housing for all or housing for all, is that making sure that we have options for everyone, making sure that we're looking at these things from a smart framework so that we can understand that we're going to create some guidelines so that these issues don't happen, and so that everyone has an equitable access to housing. Housing is a right, right? And we should make sure that people have access to it and make sure that we have systems in place so that can happen. People may say, oh, well, is it against short-term rentals? Actually, no, that's not the case. I'm for smart frameworks. I definitely want to see people have the opportunity to, if you want to go rent your home out for the summer, and make extra buck, or two to get yourself, through the next 6 months, or for your kids, to get through college, I'm all for that, right? But what I'm not for is these out-of-town developers who are coming in and buying homes by the mass, and then turning them into short-term rentals that they all care about is profit. My goal is to fight back against developers, these millionaires and corporate billionaires, who are coming into our communities, right? Even local, state, federal, to just they'll get more rich, and we don't reap the benefits, right? We get taxed for their inability to be taxed, and so that's what I mean by that.
So this is actually a very timely conversation because literally on October 22nd of 2024, the city of Prairie Village, Kansas, which is in Johnson County, which is a fairly progressive county, and it's a county in which my mom lives in. But during its meeting on October 21st, 2024, the Prairie Village City Council amended the city's rental licensing program to require a minimal rental duration of 30 days. The move bans short-term rentals within the city limits. Current short-term rentals, including those listed on sites like VRBO and Airbnb, have always been required to obtain a rental license to operate in Prairie Village. The rental license process is the same for both long-term and short-term rentals. The license must be renewed annually and requires an annual exterior inspection to ensure compliance with the property maintenance code. The new requirement for a 30-day minimum stay will go into effect November 1st of 2025, so literally in the next couple of weeks. Short-term rentals will continue to be permitted until that time while still subject to all other city codes, including nuance codes. Timing of the enforcement is to allow city staff to notify property owners to allow property owners to change the use of their property to allow those with existing bookings to have those bookings honored through that period and to minimize difficulties for staff and affected property owners during the phase out of short-term rentals. Residents who need to report a municipal code violation at short-term rental can contact the police department. I think so. Essentially, they gave a big like "fuck you" essentially to Airbnb, and it's like we're going to focus more on like our local renters. And I know that they will require any property owner or any property owned by someone outside of the county, they must identify a local resident, agent, or manager. And the current process will stay in effect for 1 year. They're also, I believe, they're the first city in Kansas to actually do this. And I grew up in Missouri, and I don't think that I know of any that have done it in Missouri, other than like some of the smaller cities. But this is a really this kind of sets the tone a little bit, because they're tired of these predatory companies and these billionaires coming in and buying up these properties. And they do these short-term rentals. Meanwhile, we have a housing crisis that continues to skyrocket, and the prices continue to go up and wages go down. Like, it ain't fair. It's not right.
No,
Now,
I mean, again, so I'm glad that they did that, and hopefully that could be a model for the rest of the state. For other localities to look at, or at least re replicate. But as I did have these discussions with people, I think sometimes people think I'm really trying to be like innovative, and honestly, I'm not. Like, this is stuff that's already has happened across New York, across the country, as people really looking at it this way. And that's why I think it's, again, Local politics matter now more than ever, because now that our federal government is the way it is, people were like, oh, actually, like, now let's continue to harm and exploit our localities, and maybe I can make a rich, but get richer, or maybe help my friends get richer, or maybe pad my pockets another way. Not saying that's happening here locally, but we know that's an issue across the nation. And so we have amazing organizations like Run for Something that are trying to educate and provide people the opportunity to learn how to get organized and get access to resources to run. So that's what I'm bringing is, again, I was homeless, right? Here we have so much, NIMBY, which is not in my backyard, or like, oh no, we don't want to create affordable housing because we're gonna bring in, the mental health issues, the individuals who have substance use disorders, all these kinds of things. And what I tell people is like, actually, let me stop you right there. I was born and raised in public housing, and if it wasn't for that public housing, we wouldn't have had another place to live. And that public housing was my community, right? That building was filled with DTs that loved me, filled with individuals that looked out for me, and it was community, right? And we weren't ever worried about, oh gosh, this and that, right? No, that was our community, like that was our place, our people, my roots. And so I remind people of that. It's like, actually, no, like I'm from public housing. So you're trying to tell me if I ever needed it, like you wouldn't have want me here. And so like I always remind people of that. And I always remind people of like other issues is that this isn't just about low income housing. It's literally opportunities for housing for all. And these preconceived and honestly hateful and hurtful ways that people think of each other or their neighbors that are living in these houses, it has to stop. I mean, it's just downright disgusting. And so I remind people is like, actually, no, I come from that community, and so is my whole family, and my family still lives in those situations. And I've been homeless as well, right? And so, like, if I didn't have access to resources and welcomed by this community, I wouldn't have had a place to live. And I have served those who have been unhoused here, both from safety issues and just hit by hard times. And like, just because you're unhoused or may need a temporary place to stay, doesn't make you a bad person by any means, right? And we have to stop this. Like, and like, honestly, some of these people that are out there like spewing that hateful rhetoric is like, you were poor too, right? Like, stop it. We're all one paycheck or one crisis away, or one car accident or medical issue away from being hit by crisis and hard times. And like, we can't, we need to stop and forget that. And like, we need to lift each other up and support our neighbors and support our community. And so, like, as I have these conversations, I just make sure that I remind myself of who I am and what I stand for, and also show people like, no, actually, like I'm the same way. And if it wasn't for the community who supported me when I was fighting cancer, like we could have been homeless, or we could have to give up our home, or had all these, medical debts, and things like that. Or maybe I wouldn't have even been able to go get the treatment that I needed because, what if my wife wasn't a teacher here and had great health insurance? All these kinds of things that people don't understand, we need, and the community needs, of us.
Absolutely. And I think this ties into like your next platform, topic and focus is safe and healthy communities. This can look like a lot of things. Now, whenever I think of like a safe and healthy community, I think about, infrastructure that keeps the neighborhood safe. I think about, the need to recognize gun violence as a public health issue. I think about, ensuring that, properties are up to code and, just things like that. There's like a lot that goes into that. Now, what does a safe and healthy community look like in regards to your platform? Like, what are you advocating for with safe and healthy communities?
For me, at its core, when I talk about that is a community for all of us, Right. And that ties into transparency as well, as a town government that is truly for the people, truly for the community, and creating an environment where we lift up each other, we support each other, and we also work through issues together in a very positive space. Right. And so again, safe and healthy communities is all those things that you shared, Zach. It's about, having an infrastructural plan. It's about ensuring that I have a preparedness plan. God forbid, we were hit by another flood or another, crisis, a medical or natural disaster, right? Being prepared to respond that way. And so th that's what I think about beyond when I look at safe and health of communities. Obviously, people are always going to think about the criminal justice response of it. And that's not what I'm thinking about when I talk about it. Obviously, law enforcement and is needed to respond to unsafe situations that have happened or may be in the process of happening. And I'm not sitting here saying that I'm anti-police by any means. Actually, is quite far from it. And people that know me will understand that know that I'm actually I work very well with law enforcement. I'm supportive of them. I work on policy issues with them. I serve with the governor for the governor on the Law Enforcement Accreditation Council here in New York. So I'm very pro police, right? Not pro bad police, but pro like community level police that I see and that I associate myself with. Obviously, we all know there's other issues that are I don't agree with beyond that, right? And so that's a part of it. And it's just creating these thriving communities where we all can really have an opportunity to speak and be heard. One of my goals, if I do get into office, is to create just like a community board, right? A space where people can say, hey, I think my neighbor is having a hard time shoveling. Is there anything out there that we can do for them? Things that we could talk about outside of a business meeting is like, hey, like, I can't afford this. What resources out there? And so for me, it's like bringing my network with me and bringing my skills to really just pick up a phone and just say, hey, what's out there? Or who do we know? Or what can we do? Is really just like creating a network of coalition here within our community, and also that spreads throughout, just to lift each other up and support each other and just bring new things and new resources and create a new community system here.
Will, we were just talking about, and this is happening like literally in real time. Now, there was an update, which today is, October 20th. I actually had to like physically look and see what the date was because my days are all running together. But in the state of the world and the state of the country, we see funding being cut at astronomical rates for crucial services. And it's going to begin impacting different hotlines and different, like it can definitely impact like the suicide prevention lifeline. It can impact the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Speaking of which, National Domestic Violence Hotline has on their story, we're currently experiencing intermittent disruptions or disruption of our chat, text, and call services at this time. Now, there's no other information about this, other than they're experiencing that, but you can't help but think, what about the survivors that really need to talk to somebody right now? What about those that are going through something astronomically horrific and they need somebody to talk to, and those services are no longer there? Like think about that for a second. And let anybody who's listening, like think about that for a minute. And this is happening literally in real time on October 20th, 2025, at 11:47 a.m. Central Time, we get updates like this, and we see updates like that. I think this is a crucial moment to talk about because, in the state of the world right now, we're going to continue seeing stuff like this. We're going to continue experiencing these longer call times for the suicide prevention lifeline. Like, it's 2025. We shouldn't be having this conversation about funding. Like, it's a common sense thing. You would think it's common sense, but clearly it's not for a lot of people. Clearly, they're not waking up and seeing what the hell is happening right now. I mean, you scroll through social media, you look at the comments. That right there is an example of why we need to continue to have the Department of Education, because clearly people are not getting it. People are not understanding. I know what I learned in government class. I mean, that's one of the actually very few classes that I actually did fairly well in. I got a straight A in it. Plus, I also had one of the best teachers. Shout out to Ms. Weatherford, literally one of the best American government teachers, literally ever. My mom even loved her because she's wild. She's such a good person, though. Probably one of my favorite teachers, one of the best teachers, literally ever. But not every teacher is like that. I understand that, but Ms. Weatherford, Angela Weatherford, one of my favorite teachers, just had to add that shameless plug in there. But what's your reaction to the state of the world right now? And like just everything that's kind of going on across the country, everything that's going on across the world. What is your vision for a world that we can all come together and recognize the need for these services to continue on and this funding to continue going? I mean, the government shut down. We're going on day number 19 of this, or almost 20 days of the government shutdown. What's your thoughts?
So I had the privilege of hearing Malcolm Kenyatta, Pennsylvania rep, Malcolm Kenyatta, and also DNC chair, vice chair, speak a couple of weeks ago. And he had said something that I still, believe, and resonates with me so much. He had said basically, how we are embredded on all sides of the political landscape to, hate one another or, be divisive or, create these environments where, hate or distrust or other things are bred, right? And I think at the core level is that we are seeing at this, beyond the tipping point, right? Now it's almost like this like massive, well, we all know like what's happening. And so how did we move on from there, right? How do we move on beyond like just genuinely always being pissed off at each other? And I think it's just not, it's about just getting to a place where we're having honest conversations on these issues and understanding that at the end of the day, I'm a person. We have children, we can resonate because we have children to each together. We may come from the same community, we may like the same sports teams. Right, like there's still ways for us to connect and have these conversations. And so when I talk about why I'm running and who I'm running for, like honestly, I'm here for all people, right? Not just one that may vote a certain way or ones that vote for me. Like no, I'm here for everyone. So you could love me, you could hate me, you cannot vote for me, but I'm still going to make sure that our community is safe for you. I still will show up for you if you need it. I still show up at your event. I will still listen to you and help you or make sure your community isn't being rezoned illegally, right? And so that's what I think at the core that we have to look at. And I don't have the answer regarding the funding, Zach. I don't. All I keep telling people is like it's going to be a lot worse before it gets better, and I don't have the answer. And I just tell people like, look at innovative ways and how we can ensure that we continue to offer people these services. Down to like basic, phone calls or texting, right? But it's hard. It's hard. And if we can't have these national orgs, is there ways to create grassroots movements, right? Where we're doing train the trainers to help, respond or have access to, local crisis counselors, things like that. It's like looking again, like, these grassroots tactics that we have seen, going back, what is, 80, 90 years when they were doing, the Vietnam War and things like that, how the community came together to support each other through these hard times. And it's honestly going back to that is like, understanding that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And how can we support each other through this time?
I think you hit on a crucial aspect about how can we support each other through these times. And I think the individual donations to nonprofit organizations, even if it's like 50 cents or if it's a dollar or $10 or $100, you know, whatever people have to give, donating to these nonprofit organizations that literally bend over backwards for survivors and ensuring that these crucial services remain active, because we know that the government is not going to save us. We understand that Congress is complicit in silence. They're not going to save us. And I recognize that. And I think the older that I get, the more I recognize that my, again, going back to my teacher, Ms. Weatherford, she was right. Because she kind of laid it out in a way. I think she kind of went off curriculum a little bit. But she had us understand like the state of everything that then the way that it's like heading. And she was correct. And you know, my entire class took like a gasp whenever she said, like, you know, history does repeat itself. And she's absolutely right, unfortunately. Now, jumping into the, you know, speaking of government, speak, you know, jumping into your last part on your platform is transparent government, neighbors, not insiders. That needs to be a graphic in itself. You know, you will fight for open meetings, plain language updates, real opportunities to shape the decisions that affect the community. What does a transparent government look like in your on your platform? And like, what does it look like to you?
So, it is 2025, right? We're all on our phones doing things that we have never been able to do. And there's no reason why we can't make meetings accessible. Honestly, there's so many systems and policies and models for everyone to follow. And at its core, this is another reason that creates issues within the community, right? And another, if we lift this up and change this makes their community feel more in tune with what's happening. They may feel more safer, they may feel more likely to enter, either running for an office or coming to the meeting. So there's no reason why these board minutes, agendas, et cetera, are not put a week ahead with all the applications attached to it. There's no reason why I should be getting just a basic agenda that's being set by the leadership that is only released, less than 20, 24 hours the minimum before the meeting. So, making sure that all that information is out there, making sure that it's public, and making sure that people understand the situation, right? I truly want people to be educated and informed. There's no reason why I want to hide anything from the agenda. I'll put it all out there, honestly. And if it's something that's so contentious that people like are, no one can come to an agreement, then put it to a vote, right? Like these are not unheard things, but these are things that when people don't. I don't want to say care for the community, but when people aren't informed of all the ways of how they can lead innovatively and lead with empathy and care and understand that it's not about a political position, it's truly about being an act of service, that's when change happens. And so when we create all these simple changes by having, making meetings accessible, making sure that everyone knows who to call, where to view things, making sure people understand the process, can track it, and read everything, as thoroughly as they can to prepare for public hearings, et cetera. Like when we change these little things, that will just create a better atmosphere for not only the government, but for the community as well.
Absolutely. And I feel that if the community changes, the government needs to. If the government changes, we need to see better community structures. And I know you recognize that. And I love that. I love that about your platform. I just love your platform in general because it's right to the point. You know, it doesn't give like these very long-winded explanations. It's right to the point, and you say it best on the ontons. deserve a town hall that's open, honest, and accountable. Keyword is accountable. Keyword is accountable. And that goes into every single aspect of your platform. That keyword accountable right there. Because what is a government if we can't hold them accountable for their actions, but also their inaction? and their complicity in silence. So, Will, again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. You know, it's always an honor to sit down and talk to you. And this is gonna be one of many conversations. You have an open invite anytime you want to be on the podcast, anytime you want something, amplified. You obviously know that. And to anybody out there who wants to learn more about like your work and like who you are, where can they find you on social media and what are your handles and what platforms are you on?
Oh yeah, I mean if we're looking at like campaign wise, what is it? Shoot, I don't even know. I think it's a Will for Oniana, both on Instagram it's Will for Oniana, and on Facebook it's Will for Oniana Town Supervisor. But my personal handle where I'm really unhinged, it's a WR, it's on Instagram, it's a WRNY advocate. And so that is my advocacy platform. And that's not affiliated with anything that I'm doing politically in my roles or job. And so yeah, everyone can find me there. I'm also on LinkedIn, which is it's what is it? My handle is Rivera WD, or you could just search for me, Will Rivera. You'll see like it's like a purplish that says like fighting for a world without sexualized violence or something like that. So definitely, yeah, reach out to me all the time. I'm always available. I'm always here to help, always, here to work together, or collaborate on a multitude of things.
Absolutely. You take care of yourself, my friend, okay?
All right, Zach, take care.
Thank you.